Hello, everyone. Welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. And this week, before we get started, I want to thank a handful of people who have made Talk Nerdy possible. I want to start by thanking Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and Chuck Pell for their support through Patreon. If you're interested in supporting through that portal, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy. I also want to thank Dale Stevens, who's representing here the Women in Technology at the National Australia Bank. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you so much for reaching out through my PayPal portal on my website. If you're interested in supporting that way, you can visit carasantamaria.com and click through the links there. You can also access an entire backlog of Talk Nerdy episodes. You can see all of the work that I've done on television and the web, well, at least the work that I'm allowed to post there. And lastly, you can click through to the Talk Nerdy store and pick up some swag while you're visiting. All right, guys, I'm really excited about my guest this week. I know I say that every week, but, well, I do kind of always mean it, too. But I'm extra excited because, as you know, hopefully by this point, I recently joined the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast as their fifth rogue. And I was lucky enough to steal away an hour of time from probably one of the busiest men on the planet, Dr. Stephen Novella. He is, I would say, the host, or at least the first co-host of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, along with his two brothers, Jay and Bob, and also Evan Bernstein. And he's also the president of the New England Skeptical Society. He also has a full-time job, believe it or not, as a clinical neurologist and professor at Yale. So I'm really excited to chat with him. I hope that you guys love this episode just as much as I loved doing it. Here he is, Dr. Stephen Novella. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'm so excited to sit down and chat with you. I've already had Jay on the podcast. I'm going to have to start picking you guys off one by one after this.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm really thrilled, obviously, about the announcement that, let's see if we can get the timeline right, that was made 2 days ago as of the date of this airing on SGU, that I'm joining as the fifth rogue.
Yeah, I know. We were all really excited about it as well. I mean, we did an exhaustive international search, and after, literally about 6 months of scouring the globe for the best additional rogue, we settled on you. Actually, you were our first interview that we did while we were sort of casually looking, and you were immediately the one to beat, and no one even came close.
Oh, that's amazing. That's so sweet to hear. I was blown away. I remember when you guys wanted to Skype so that you could tell me the news and invite me on the show, and you were being so sneaky and secretive. You're like, no, we need to Skype. I was like, what's it about? And you're like, let's just Skype. I was like, okay.
Oh, yeah, I couldn't really say without giving the whole thing away. And yeah, we didn't want to email to you. We wanted to talk to you.
Yeah, so that was really... I was floored. So I'm really thrilled about it. I'm excited actually to get started. You know, we did a live show at TAM. That was really fun, but that also meant that we get to take a week off. And so now I'm like, oh, let's get into it. Let's start doing SGU. I have to ask you though, before I really get into your background and how SGU came together, why a rogue? Where does that word come from?
That is a Star Wars reference. Gotcha. I kind of like the term also. We're like the skeptical rogues. Like, don't mess with us. You know, we early on when we first started the show, we were brainstorming all kinds of stuff. And we had, multiple different suggestions for the name of the show, for the tagline of the show, et cetera, et cetera. And that's basically just what shook out. You know, the name of the show, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, our tagline is Your Escape to Reality. And we're the skeptical rogues. I forget all of the creative twists and turns we took to get there, but that's basically what shook out.
I love it. Can you remember back to when you were trying to come up with the best? Did you have any kind of second or third place ideas? Did SGU almost get called something else?
It did. I mean, we thought of a lot of different things. I do remember that it was Perry who came up with the name. So we're all fans of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. And that the movie version of that was in theaters when we were, or just maybe had just been in theaters when we were brainstorming. And Perry said, as if it were the only obvious choice, no, we're The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And as soon as he said it that way, we all knew that that was going to be it.
I love it. It's so good. And so now it's 10 years on. I mean, you guys just celebrated your 10th anniversary a few months ago, right?
Yep, that's right. Yeah, we're over 500 episodes and we just passed 10 years.
Wow. So it's been quite a journey. I want to know about those early days. What made you, I mean, a physician, a neurologist, actually, somebody with a family, somebody who works very hard, think, I know, I've got some free time. I think this might be something I want to do.
Well, you know, we had been running the New England Skeptical Society for about 10 years at that point, maybe 9 years. We started in 1996. And we're always looking for stuff to do. You know, we've been doing the usual local skeptical group stuff, publishing a newsletter and doing investigations, holding meetings, you know, writing articles. And that was fine, but, you know, we wanted to be something bigger. Back in the day, it was a little frustrating running a local skeptical group because you're pretty isolated. It's not like you're a chapter of a national group or anything. That model still doesn't really exist within the skeptical community. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Web 2.0, if you will, where it was hitting its stride. You know, blogs were taking off and social media was just starting. YouTube was just starting. I mean, the world is really rapidly changing. And so this just became a way to create online content for our group, you know. So it originally was just like the podcast of the New England Skeptical Society. But of course, it quickly took on a life of its own and completely surpassed anything else that we were doing.
But in doing that, and it in some ways, like you said, eclipsing the other stuff, you never lost those ties. You're still actively working with and for the New England Skeptical Society.
Yeah, I mean, there was no reason not to continue forward with that group. And we just sort of divided the labor. So the New England Skeptical Society runs the science-based medicine blog. It operates my personal blog, Neurologica, and we co-sponsor Nexus, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, along with the New York City Skeptics. We still occasionally do meetings and investigations, and that we focus more on local activism, essentially, with that group. And then we moved all of our media production to SGU Productions, which is a private company. And so that now produces the SGU and all of our YouTube channel and our Facebook page and all of the related content. So it's a pretty good division of labor. We wanted to have a professional production company to really try to break through to the next level. You know, where we're not just producing a podcast, but lots of different types of content.
Yeah, and that makes sense, too. I think as you grow and as you start to have a stronger social media presence, and again, you have content on a bunch of different platforms, it gets to be overwhelming. You know, you almost have to centralize it and have a game plan and have a business model. Otherwise, you're kind of missing opportunities.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because the New England Skeptical Society is a nonprofit. SGU Productions is for-profit. And that was very deliberate also because honestly, we don't have the infrastructure to run a large nonprofit. Running mm-hmm. a small nonprofit is relatively easy because if you're below a certain level, it's, you know, you don't really have to jump through too many hoops. But once you rise above that level, then the administrative duties are overwhelming. We would have spent all of our time just basically servicing, you know, the administrative duties of running a large nonprofit. For profit is easy. You just pay your taxes and nobody cares.
True.
Yeah, so it's a lot easier.
You're not trying to get, and it's not that nonprofits are getting away with loopholes or anything, but you don't have to do nearly as much paperwork to prove to the government that you're not spending that money on things other than outreach or, you know, whatever you need to do as a nonprofit. It actually seems like it's almost easier if your nonprofit gets big and starts to get out of hand, just file as a religion.
Yeah, yeah, obviously we weren't going to do that, but yeah, but you still, even if you file as a religion, I'm pretty sure you still have to, there's still a lot of regulatory loopholes, hoops you have to jump through to maintain you know, completely above board with all of the nonprofit stuff. This way, the other thing is we wanted to, you know, start paying people. You know, I love volunteers. We survive on volunteers. A lot of people want to donate their time to the cause, and that's great. But when people start doing it for us on a regular basis, like we have a relationship with them, I think it's even if it's we're underpaying everybody, we're not paying market value because we couldn't afford that. You know, we have people doing computer work for us and artwork and lots of technical stuff, you know, video production. If we were paying market value for that, we'd go broke tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So they're still semi-volunteers. But when you say, all right, but here's the deal. We're going to give you this amount of money every month and you're going to do these duties for us, the relationship changes and it's much better. The expectations are much more solid. I feel better about asking people to do stuff if I'm giving them something in return and it's not just goodwill. Because we've done the 100% pure volunteer model for years under the nonprofit and it's okay, but outside of my family and close friends like Evan, it is hard to crack the whip on people consistently for years, you know, while not paying them. They have to have some other skin in the game.
Oh, totally. If somebody's like, I can't make it, you kind of can't blame them.
Right. I have nothing to hold over them. You know, everything they're giving to me is out of the goodness of their heart. They're volunteering. So anyway, for short term or for focused projects, that's great. But for long term work, it's much better to be able to have a more of a formal business relationship with people. So that was the model we chose when we wanted to like really expand our work and you know start to move into other areas. So we have, you know, lots of people now working with and for us, and we couldn't be producing what we're producing any other way. I mean, we're pretty full just doing the podcast. In terms of the technical work that we do, like we don't have there's not enough hours in the day to like do post-production on YouTube videos or any of the other stuff that we're doing. So we had to start collaborating with a lot of other people to expand what we were doing.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, you guys have, what is it? Something like, what is your listenership? Are you public with those numbers?
Yeah. We've always just said what they were. So as you know, because you have your own podcast, how you count the numbers is variable. There's no one way to do it. The way I have always counted our numbers is the number of downloads we're getting per episode. Mm-hmm. So it takes about 4 to 5 weeks for that to plateau. So where our episodes are plateauing, like there are 4 to 5 week old episodes are plateauing. That's the number that I consider. And right now we're at about 180,000.
Wow. That is really impressive. That must be in the top like 2% of podcasts. That must be way up there.
There's tons of small podcasts. So yeah, it must be 0.1%, I would imagine. But yeah, and then, you know, we follow every couple of months or so, I take a peek at iTunes to see where we are in the rankings. And we tend to hover around somewhere in the top 10 of science podcasts. Mm-hmm. It could bounce around, though. As some, you know, new people enter the game, they usually will pop up there at least for a short period of time as everybody checks them out. And there's, you know, I don't know exactly how iTunes counts its rankings. It's not pure numbers.
They have weird algorithms.
Yeah, they do some weird algorithms, so mm-hmm. I can't always track it exactly. But we're always, you know, settling in back into the top 10 somewhere.
That's great. And so you mentioned, obviously, that in the iTunes rankings, you are listed, just like my podcast is listed, as a science podcast. And of course, the vast majority of the content on the show is science content. Has it been that way since the beginning? Did you want this to be a science podcast with a skeptical bent? Or did you really set out to do a skeptic podcast that sometimes discusses science?
Yeah, I think we wanted it to be both from the beginning. You know, science and skepticism, science and critical thinking, you know, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it, because that's essentially our passions. And everything that we've done has always been a combination of the two. You know, even like when we were just running the New England Skeptical Society, we would host lectures that were pure science lectures, you know, just a scientist talking about science, not just, you know, paranormal, supernatural, skeptical, critical thinking topics. Although, you know, we definitely cover way more pseudoscience, paranormal, critical thinking than a regular science outlet. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of just hard science in there as well. And essentially, I mean, I do try to balance it. We do very consciously try to balance everything in the podcast. But it's also partly just whatever catches our interest, you know, because if we're interested in it, we figure other people will be interested in it.
Sure. And it's a huge community out there of skeptics who, and I think there's so much crossover with evidence-based thinking, with scientific thought, with, you know, some rejection of religion, and then with pseudoscience and trying to debunk, you know, mystics and psychics and conspiracy theories and stuff like that. It's really interesting how much it all kind of overlaps. And so I really want to, you know, talk about you personally, which is something that I feel like on the show, it's very topical a lot of times. And even though you can really get a good sense of kind of the brotherhood and the friendships and the personalities, one thing that you don't probably do as much as maybe I do on my podcast is get super personal. So I'm going to use this excuse now to get personal sure. with you. So in many ways, you're kind of the godfather of Skeptic's Guide. I mean, it's sort of your brainchild. You are at the center of this sort of, I guess, movement, really. And you are the oldest brother of the Novelli, as we like to call
them. That's not true. That's
not
true.
Oh, it's not true.
Bob is 1 year older than I am.
Bob is 1 year older than you. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I did not know that.
I know we don't look like it. Because I have the premature gray hair. I mean, I was gray when I was 30, you know, so.
And did Bob?
Yeah.
Did he kind of take that oldest brother role very seriously?
Did Bob?
Yeah.
No. So I mean, Bob has a twin. First of all, so Bob and Joe are both a year older than I am.
Mm-hmm.
We also have an older sister who's 4 years older than I am, and Jay is 4 years younger than I am. So Bob, Joe, and I were in the middle, and the three of us always behaved as if we were sort of the same age. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and you weren't that different in age.
Yeah, just 1 year. And actually, yeah. Bob did a year of pre-primary before going into first grade. So actually, Bob and I were in the same grade.
Oh,
and then Joe was 1 year ahead of us in school. So, yeah, so for that reason, if anything, Joe acted like the older brother.
Because he was a grade ahead.
He was a grade ahead, yeah. But the three of us really were just pretty much acted as colleagues, you know, as peers or whatever.
And what about your older sister? Was she the boss?
No, not really. I mean, she was always the prima donna of the family. no question. Not quite the boss. And then when we got college age, you know, the big thing that happened is that my sister became born again.
Mm-hmm.
We were all raised Catholic, but by then, and we were just your typical sort of casual Catholics. We would, you know, go to church a few times a year, and yeah, we believed, but it was never really a huge part of our life. And then as we got like into college age, you know, at least Bob, and Jay and I, you know, became atheists, and Sandra at the same time that we were becoming atheists, she was becoming a born again Christian. So that, as we say, that made Sunday dinners very interesting.
Gotcha. And what about Bob's twin? What's his name again?
Joe.
Is Joe just kind of, was this world just not that interesting to him? He was kind of neutral to it?
We were always interested in science, and he mm-hmm. definitely shared our interest in science, but his wife, who he's now divorced from, mm-hmm. but at the time she was Catholic, and, you know, he kind of separated from the family to some extent. I mean, we never obviously lost touch with him. He's our brother, but, you know, he definitely was focused more on her and that end of the family, and you know, she was very strongly Catholic, so I don't think he was going to,
sure,
you know, come out as a strong atheist at that time. So yeah, that was still going on when we were getting into the podcasting. So he just wasn't as tight as Jay, Bob, and I were when that happened.
Do you think that there's hope yet?
Well, I mean, Joe is definitely a skeptic and an atheist mm-hmm. at this point in his life, but he hasn't been doing this for 20 years. You know what
sure.
I mean?
Sure, sure.
It's, you know, it's one thing to be a self-identified skeptic. It's another thing to have been, you know, eating and breathing it for 20 years.
Yeah, and to be working kind of actively as an activist in that realm.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of effort. So what about your folks, though? Are they still Catholic?
My father is, mm-hmm. Still hasn't given up hope on his kids, even though there is no hope. And my mother has always been like a casual atheist, which is something we didn't even know
uh-huh.
until we said, yeah, basically we don't believe in God anymore. she's more of like of a cynical atheist, if you will. She just is like, ah, it's all crap. You know, she doesn't really believe in it. Not really like a grounded philosophical atheist. Just she never really had any need for it. Doesn't really believe. And she kept that to herself when we were growing up. She went along with the Catholic thing. And like we never even knew, you know, growing up that she was an atheist.
That's kind of badass. That must have been sort of exciting to find out.
Yeah, it was nice, you know, that she was, you know, understood where we were coming from. Father's very unhappy with the fact that, you know, four of his five children are atheists.
I'm sure. I mean, I had a similar experience where my dad is still very strongly Mormon. And my mom, I think, honestly, I don't know if she would call herself an atheist, but I think secular humanist is a good title for her. Mm-hmm. She has some woo-woo ideas and things like that, but she's definitely not a believer. But I don't think that that really came out until my parents got divorced. I'm not sure if had they stayed married. Well, I'm not sure if they could have stayed married, because in many ways, sometimes when this happens, it does have an effect on the relationships and how the family stays together. I definitely had to, in many ways, break up with my father when I came out as an atheist. We got back together later in life. But for a lot of kids, especially, I was 15. How old were you when you first told your parents?
Well, I don't think there was ever a time where we said, you know, Mom, Dad, I got to tell you something. I'm an atheist. I mean, that never happened. It was more as they kind of were up to date as I was going through the process. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing. We have a very vocal family. We talk about everything. You know, we don't. It's not like I was hiding it away until I had to reveal it to them. They saw the whole process unfold, like starting to question, you know, every step of the way. Then there was a sort, you know, at one point, I do remember there was one time where I was having yet another argument with my father. Again, we would be discussing these issues over years. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me like, wow, you're really an atheist. It's like, yeah, that's right, Dad. As I've been telling you now for a while, I don't believe in God. Like, it just really hit him that I was an atheist, you know?
Yeah, I think there's that moment at the beginning where it's like, he's just trying to weasel out of going to church.
Yeah, in fact, he said that. He said, you just don't want to go to church. Yeah, right, Dad. I'm adjusting my philosophical worldview just to avoid one task that I don't like. But yeah, I think it's when he realized that I was serious. I seriously don't believe in God. Yeah.
And did you find that first? I mean, that was my experience. I was an atheist long before I was embracing science as an academic pursuit. Did it happen hand in hand for you, or did one happen before the other?
No, the science came first. And I do think it's interesting you say that, because I, you know, having been in the movement for a couple of decades, I do find, not to create a false dichotomy, but you know, there are two often flavors of atheists/skeptics. There are those who were atheists first because they had a bad experience with religion and really reject religion, and that's where their passion is. And then there are those who are like pro-science first, like the science is really where their passion is. And then the atheism, yeah, sure, they're an atheist, but that's not where their passion lies. Mm-hmm. So I'm definitely at the science end of the spectrum. I was, you know, my love of science and critical thinking has driven everything. And then, you know, I got rid of my faith and my religion, you know, because I had to, you know, in order to be intellectually honest. I never had bad experiences with religion. Again, it was always a positive part of my life growing up. You know, it's not like I was abused or something, or it was ever oppressive or overwhelming. Again, it was this mild thing in the background that was just a source of culture and, you know, unity and really, you know, positive things. Mm-hmm. But the magic aspect of it, I sort of compartmentalized off, but eventually those walls had to break down.
Yeah. And for a lot of people, I think, you know, I have people reach out to me. I actually just had a letter recently, I think through Facebook, somebody reached out to me sort of thanking me for my podcast being listenable to by him. Okay, this is getting confusing. Yeah. He identified as a Christian who is very science-minded. And for me, that's sometimes hard to imagine. You know, I couldn't remain in the church and still be as science-minded as I am, but I know that some people can. And I do think that it's important not to just minimize their experience. So, you know, for you, you became a neurologist. You studied science in school. You went on to study medical school, mm-hmm. And it was hard for you to reconcile the two. But I mean, do you think and do you understand that there are people out there who can reconcile those things?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. So I think that sometimes, depending on what your experience with Christianity is, for example, mm-hmm. But the same is true, I think, of the other major religions, you may think that like being a Christian is being a fundamentalist.
Yeah.
And it really isn't. So like we were raised Catholic, and the Catholic Church is interesting because within the Catholic Church, you have the full spectrum from really fundamentalist Catholics, charismatic Catholics at one end to like Jesuits at the other end who are very scholarly. And even today I know Catholics, even like, you know, dare I say a Catholic priest who, you know, belief, the magic is just not there. You know, they take a very scholarly, philosophical, moralistic approach to the faith. And the magic in the faith itself is a very small part. And that was my experience. That was the kind of Catholicism that we grew up with. In fact, we went to a Jesuit prep school. And again, the Jesuit tradition, you know, it tends towards the more scholarly end of the spectrum, if you will. So, yeah, if you're that kind of Catholic, you know, then you almost become a deist, you know, where there's this just vague, abstract, unfalsifiable idea of God. And Christianity really is an ethical stance, which is not an unreasonable one. And everything else is interpreted. You know, you don't take anything literally. So it is very easy to have a version of Christianity that is completely compatible with rationality and science, you know, except for that one bit of faith that you reserve for yourself.
Yeah, for the concept of God, however you define that. I mean, for me, I feel like, you know, it's a brand that has baggage. So mm-hmm. I would always hope that people would call that version of God just something else. You know what I mean? Because it's a bit complicated when you call God, you know, I don't know. Some people will try to define it as something that's very cosmological or physics based, you know, some sort of all of the energy that exists within the universe, because it's a somewhat closed system. They might want to call that God, and how it organizes is up to nature. And I get it. And I think that that's an interesting way to reconcile those things. But I do kind of get bummed out that they use the word God, because I can't help but think of like bearded dude in the sky.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then for those people, it's like, oh, you're taking such a childish, you know, straw man version of what, you know, theology really is. I disagree with that position, but that's how they feel. That's how they've expressed it to me. It's like, no, this is the religion is the whole spectrum. Sure, there's the sort of benign intellectual version that you're talking about, but there's lots of other versions as well. Both, as you say, within the Christian brand, within other major religions, you have to, you know, recognize the fact that it goes all the way to the most, you know, obscene versions of fundamentalist belief systems. The whole thing is under the rubric of religion and even Christianity. But nobody likes that, right? Nobody wants to be tarred with the negative aspects of other things that share their brand.
Oh, for sure. You know what I mean? Yeah. I especially see that with my Jewish friends. You know, I grew up in Texas, so I knew like two Jews my whole childhood. But then when I moved to New York and then LA, I was like, oh, this is a thing. Like, there's a lot of people. And one of my very best friends in the whole world is an atheist Jew, which was so hard for me to understand, this idea of being culturally Jewish and religiously devoid of faith. And it's just something that doesn't seem to exist in the Christian tradition, that you would be maybe Catholic, but an atheist Catholic.
Yeah, but think about it, though. So, yeah, I mean, Evan's a cultural Jew, right? Evan on the show, on the SGU. Which, what does that mean? It means he has Seder with his family and, you know, whatever, those things. So, like, in my family, we celebrate Easter and Christmas. You know, we hide the Easter eggs on Easter and we give presents on Christmas. Who cares, you know, what the origin of it is? I know it's, yes, it's part of the brand, but things like the holidays have been co-opted for cultural reasons forever, right? That's just the history of our culture. And in fact, Christmas is not an originally Christian holiday. it predates all, you know, all of the date and the traditions and the whole idea that now are wrapped up into the idea of Christmas are all pre-Christian.
Yeah, Easter too.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, the early Christians just co-opted the existing holidays and gave them a Christian interpretation and meaning, and that's fine. And so I could do the same thing back again. You know, I could say, yes, for me, Christmas is about family and appreciating the people that you love, and that's all it has to be about, and it's fine. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the fact that it was at some point in its history, it was interpreted as a Christian holiday, who cares? So, you know, the Easter bunny and Easter eggs, what the hell is Christian about that? There are secular versions of these holidays, and we embrace them as atheists because they're fun and the kids love them. And it's another excuse to everyone get together. We all know we're going to be available on that day, make ourselves available. It works out fine. So I see that in a way you could say I'm a sort of a secular Christian because I still have that in my roots, and I celebrate those secular versions of those holidays.
And the truth is almost everybody does. I mean, I know some people who will say, oh, it's a Festivus for the rest of us and all of that good stuff, but like they're still usually celebrating Christmas. Right. Whether you want to call it Xmas and take the Christ out of it, that's fine. But I do think there's a bit of a difference with my friends who are secular Jews, because probably, you know, I think it's linked to the issues with persecution and with the Holocaust and with ties to Israel that are much more, I think, in recent history. You know, yeah. I think Christians have a long history too of problems with persecution and all of that, but it's so tangible, you know, to be able to say, or to have to say, my grandparents went through it or my great grandparents went through it. It's so culturally identifiable still that it really forces in many ways a strong bond to the culture.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely stronger for mm-hmm. for Jewish people because that's also a genetic population, right?
Yeah, that's
actually
true.
Yeah, that's an actual population. That's like, it's like being Italian and Christian all in one, you know. Mm-hmm. It's everything to them. It's their nationality, it's their genetic heritage, it's their cultural heritage, and it's very strong. And so you can have all of those things without the belief in God and the Jewish religion, and that is a much stronger identity even than sort of me as an ex, you know, Catholic. It doesn't really mean that much anymore. You know, there's so many other things that define my background.
Oh, for sure. My friend went to Jewish day school and he speaks Hebrew and he, you know, goes back to Israel all the time. He does Israeli folk dancing. He's so Jewish, you know what I mean? But he also doesn't believe in God. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah,
and I think it's a culture that I would like to see more public, because there's so many people like that even most people who live in Israel are secular. You know, a lot of people don't realize that a big portion of the population in Israel are not Jewish. They're just Jewish, you know what I mean? Which is kind of strange and interesting. Anyway, that's like a long aside. So you said that you kind of found science first, and you've always really been a scientifically minded person. What did you study in school before you opted to go to medical school?
I took as many science courses as I could in high school. Mm-hmm. As electives, you know, so any elective time I could turn towards science, I did. So I took things like astronomy, which is completely elective in high school, as well as the usual mm-hmm. biology, physics, chemistry. And then in college, I was a natural science major. My university, Hopkins, didn't actually have a pre-med as a major. You just had to take you could take whatever major you want as long as you took all of the courses that you needed to for pre-med. And just one of the obvious ways to do that, I could have majored in biology or something else, but natural science gave me the option to mm-hmm. take whatever science I wanted, and it was fine. So I did take, again, you know, biology, physics, chemistry, but also I took astronomy and oceanography and human evolution and a lot of other courses like that. And then, you know, at the same time, most of my reading has been either science fiction or nonfiction science. Mm-hmm. Dabbling in other things, but definitely if I, you know, had my choice, I'm probably going to pick up a nonfiction science book. Most of my self-education was just mainly through watching documentaries, reading books. Again, this has been lifelong, as far back. I can't remember a time when I wasn't, you know, avidly consuming, popular science material. I know I've told this story in multiple venues, but the thing that really clicked for me, that really brought in sort of, there was really two things I should say that started me on my course towards skepticism and critical thinking. One was creationism. Mm-hmm. That was the first real hardcore pseudoscience that I encountered. And evolution and paleontology was one of my, you know, favorite sciences growing up. You know, I just loved thinking about what the world was like, you know, 70 million years ago. And the whole idea that things evolve over time, loved it. You know, I was already reading Stephen Jay Gould, etc. Mm-hmm. So the idea that there are people who don't believe, who don't accept a major, well-established science that, you know, we have come up with was just like, I had this morbid fascination with it. I wanted to understand how it is that people could reject the science of evolution.
They can literally see dinosaur bones at a museum.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, just the evidence to me was so overwhelming. So, of course, 16-year-old Stephen naively assumed that, well, I'll just explain the facts to them. You know, I'm sure they just don't know what the facts are. And so that, like, my first attempt to, like, really engage with a true believer and try to convince them of something was through evolution, you know, and creationism. And then, of course, I started to realize, wow, this is not easy. You know, people will not be dissuaded by just mere facts and evidence from something they strongly believe.
Yeah, and of course you picked a battle that was pretty intense too. That's kind of like a central tenet for a lot of these people.
It's a great forge though, man. If you mm-hmm. want to like really hone your own critical thinking skills, I honestly think you could learn every bias and logical fallacy by talking to creationists. Mm-hmm. I think they make up new ones, you know, just so they could find new ways of distorting information. And then the next thing, but at the same time, like, I was pretty confident that we were being visited by aliens and ESP was real, all that sort of stuff. Cause that's, you know, I would watch a good science documentary and then I would watch a fake science documentary telling me that, you know, aliens are real. And I didn't yet have the science and critical thinking tools to realize that one was real and the other was bullshit.
Yeah.
And the thing that I remember, again, this is always a simplified narrative of your memory, but the thing that I remember that really triggered me down the path of questioning all of that stuff was Carl Sagan in Cosmos. He had a very brief section where he just debunked some of the evidence offered for alien visitation. And he said something that really resonated with me, because I guess this had been bothering me in the back of my head for years. Mm-hmm. And he said, despite all of the sightings and all of the claims, there isn't one clear photograph. There isn't one piece of unambiguous evidence. I'm like, shit, he's totally right. I knew it. It's like, again, it's been nagging at me. It's like, when you're a believer, in my opinion, you're waiting for that smoking gun evidence that's right around the corner. Mm-hmm. You have all this tantalizing evidence, and you want to believe, but the real, really compelling evidence isn't there. And then it just took him to say what I already knew. It's like, yeah, shit, it's not there. And there's the only thing that makes sense is that we're not being visited by aliens. That's really the only way to explain this tremendous amount of low-grade crappy evidence, but not a single piece of compelling evidence.
Yeah.
And then once you have that thought, everything else crumbles almost instantly. You know, but any other belief that I had in ESP or reincarnation or any other thing that I was holding on to, just like a house of cards, within, I would say, a year, I mean, I think I had purged myself of all of that pseudoscientific belief.
There's definitely, you know, it's pretty obvious the difference, I think, between the low-hanging pseudoscientific fruit and some of the more complicated, more nuanced issues that, you know, listeners of SGU will be writing in emails about, or like asking about, is this thing real? I can't tell if the science on this is good or bad. There's some things that are more nuanced, but then there's those things like, you know, alien visitation and ESP and psychics and mystics and
Bigfoot,
all of that, that it's true. They're all kind of really related. And it's really strange to me when somebody is a firm believer in one, but it's like, oh, the other stuff's bullshit.
Yeah, I know. Although that's usually, though, there's what we call crank magnetism, where if you believe one thing, you tend to believe all of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, sometimes people have their sacred cow, the thing that they hold on to, even though they've been able to reject other belief systems. But yeah, I also think it's almost good in a way that there's still like astrology and, you know, Bigfoot and Bermuda Triangle and dowsing. That's the low hanging fruit of skepticism, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where you cut your teeth, as it were. You deal with those issues. They're pretty obviously pseudoscientific. The arguments are pretty solid on the scientific end. And then once you really wrap your head around the fact that there's, you know, insufficient evidence to support any of these things, you could go on to more nuanced things like, is global warming really happening or not? Mm-hmm. Or what's the science of genetic modification? Or, you know, things like that.
Or like I was just, I've been talking to my producers on a show that I'm not allowed to announce yet, but one of the episodes that they want to cover is something which I hadn't even heard of, but it looks like you've written about it before, this autonomous sensory meridian response.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking like, okay, I'm reading it and it sounds like bullshit, but it doesn't sound like it's something that people maybe don't experience. It just sounds like maybe ASMR is something that's some sort of behavioral or experiential thing that hasn't been explained, or it's something that, you know, could be very well explained, like by having petit mal seizures, or who knows, you know. Yeah, yeah. It's one of those odd things where it's probably more nuanced. Maybe it's not what the people who experience it want to think it is, but maybe it is still a phenomenon.
Yeah, so for your listeners, I mean, ASMR is essentially people say that there are certain things that trigger a very pleasurable sensation. Like they just feel, imagine feeling completely content, like so content that it's almost orgasmic. You know, that's kind of how they describe it. Like a braingasm is one of the terms that is frequently used.
And it's linked to like sensory experience, right?
Yeah,
so you smell something or you hear something.
Well, yeah, but there's a theme to the triggers. Mm-hmm. It's things that demonstrate careful attention to detail, especially if you're helping another person. So you will find videos on YouTube. There are thousands of videos on YouTube that people make because it's a trigger of ASMR. And one I found was somebody whispering in Latin. Just whispering in Latin. It was weird. Why is there a video of somebody whispering in Latin on YouTube? Or wrapping presents. Or just brushing somebody else's hair.
That's so weird. Yeah, and of course, for most people, they're like, okay, what is this video?
It's boring, but some people watch that and they get this tingly, pleasurable, content sensation. So enough different people report this that I think it's interesting enough that it's worth investigating. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you could say that it's a cultural phenomenon, but it's kind of a weird cultural phenomenon. And I really haven't encountered a lot of pseudoscientific explanations around it. It's just, I have this experience. It's kind of cool. I don't know what causes it. And, you know, different people sort of spontaneously reporting similar things. So from what I have seen, I tend to think it's probably a real phenomenon. One hypothesis is that it's sort of a leftover grooming response. You know how primates will groom each other. You know,
and even your dog will sit next to you and just just want to lick your hand over and over and over.
Yeah, yeah. So you think if somebody's grooming you, for you to be calm and content and to feel that this is pleasurable, so that you could sit for a few hours while somebody picks lice out of your fur. You know, there's an adaptive response there. So anyway, that's one hypothesis. It's pure speculation, but it's very intriguing, and I think it's reasonable.
It's intriguing. You know, that's what I love about the skeptic movement and about this kind of work that especially you and the SGU does, is that there are phenomena that maybe sound like bullshit, and then sometimes they turn out to be maybe legitimate. And that's that difference between the low-hanging fruit and the more nuanced stuff. I bet you early on when synesthesia was first documented, a lot of skeptics were like, yeah, that's not a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Synesthesia is really weird too.
Yeah,
the brain, that's another thing. Just the basic principle, the brain does weird stuff. So when somebody tells me my brain is doing weird stuff, my knee-jerk reaction is, okay, that's interesting. Let's think about this. Let's explore it. Not that sounds like bullshit because it's weird. Mm-hmm. I do think that, sometimes skeptics overcorrect, you know, and they do have that knee-jerk response. For example, over the years, many people have asked me about things like transcranial magnetic stimulation, mm-hmm. right? They hear magnet and they think, oh, magnets are bullshit.
Yeah.
You know,
but
so
I can tell you, I've had T, uh, T TMS done to me, and it is definitely real. It made me flick my finger.
Yeah. Oh, it's 100% real. The brain is an electrical organ, and magnetic fields induce electrical currents, which induce neurons to fire or inhibits them from firing. And so we can use this transcranial magnetic stimulation technique to either increase or decrease the functioning of a specific piece of the brain. And it has interesting effects. Its use as a therapeutic device is still on the cusp. While there's a couple of things coming out, you know, some intriguing studies, it's still mainly experimental, but it's completely reasonable. And I think that, you know, I predict over the next 20, 30 years, we're going to be using both electrical and magnetic devices to manipulate neurological function more and more. We're already doing it, but we're really just at the beginning of that as a therapeutic technology. But it does have to be distinguished from the refrigerator magnets that people are strapping to their feet, you know, because it thinks it's going to make their feet stop burning. That's where the BS is. So you got to dig to that one level deeper. You know, you can't just say magnets equal bullshit. It's, well, what kind of magnets? How are they being used? What's the claims being made? What's the evidence? You got to go that extra step and actually look at the evidence.
Yeah, I think it's very similar to a piece that I did in for Al Jazeera, for the show I do there, Techno, was about transcranial direct current stimulation, where there does seem to be some good research. There also seems to be some bullshit research. And you also seem to find that there are these DIYers that are putting voltage into their brains, and kind of willy-nilly, they're not doing it safely. And that's also a secondary thing where you do have to be a bit skeptical about that and about these products that come out on the market, like, wear this headset, it'll make you a better gamer. And you're like, what? That's not legitimate.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, like, the best scam is just one notch divorced from reality, right?
Yeah.
Because it's plausible, it's very similar to things that are real, but it's just not quite there. Those are the most compelling scams, right? So it's like the stem cell clinics. Yeah, stem cells are a real thing. It's a real technology. They were starting to, you know, do clinical trials, and there's, you know, some therapies we could see are like right on the cusp. It's perfect. It's totally ripe for somebody to set up a fake stem cell clinic and claim to actually be treating these diseases that were not quite there yet.
Yeah, and it's horrifying too, because people get very sick from this. And, you know, it's a way to prey on people who are dying of cancer, who have some sort of, you know, untreatable illness, who are willing to just empty their pockets for this last ditch thing. And oftentimes it makes them worse. They get infections.
Yeah.
Their body rejects it. Because there's only two real stem cell treatments that are fully approved, that are on the market. You can get a bone marrow transplant. That's right. Stem cells. And there are skin cell sprays that are happening now, where burn victims will actually have their individual skin cells sprayed onto them instead of doing a full sheet of transplanting. Mm-hmm. But anything else is somebody trying to take advantage of you, because those things are still in clinical trial.
Yeah, unless it is a clinical trial. So
yeah.
I think it's like, I was actually writing about this today, in fact, like, some of the low-hanging fruit there is injecting cardiac stem cells into the heart of somebody who has heart failure because they had a heart attack and some of their cells are dead. And those heart cells will just take up shop, start beating, synchronizing along with other heart cells. It's actually pretty easy technically to make that happen. And also livers, because livers regenerate.
Yeah.
You know, so they're already an organ that will regenerate itself, but sometimes the cells get burned out because they're sick, you know, they're diseased. So you put in some liver stem cells and it helps it regenerate so it can heal itself. So there's a mouse study that was recently published where that was done, and the mice livers were restored to near normal function.
It's amazing.
Yeah, so these are things that are going to happen, you know, within our lifetime. But these are sort of the easiest regenerative applications, I should say, of stem cells. You're not, you know, like, bone marrow is obviously the easiest. You just, here's some bone marrow, you know, just still very dangerous procedure, but it's technically, not, you don't have to get the bone marrow to do anything. You just need it to start functioning.
Yeah, hope that you don't reject it.
Right, rejection is always the key. But, and so the basic science of stem cells is taking off. I mean, we're figuring out how to make them from your own skin cells and things that will avoid rejection, and how to reproduce them and control them and all this sort of stuff. So that's great. While the basic science is advancing, we're just getting to the point where we're starting to see some clinical applications. But there are some serious hurdles to get over, like, how do we keep these cells from not turning into cancer? You know, that's a non-trivial problem that we have to sort out. So these things always take longer than I think people think. And then they forget about it, and then the applications start cropping up. But in the meantime, it's a setup for exploitation. But of course,
completely.
That's where skeptics come in, right? That's where we're like, wait a minute, this is BS, this is abuse, this is how you have to think about it. Because the mainstream scientific community pays too little attention to that because it's just not their expertise.
Yeah.
Being an expert in science doesn't make you an automatic expert in bullshit. You need people who are both. And I think that's where the sweet spot of the skeptical community is.
And once in a while, mainstream journalism does get it right. And I love to see it when that happens. Even 60 Minutes did an incredible expose on basically stem cell hucksters. This was kind of before they really started falling off. And I really started losing faith in 60 Minutes reporting. But yeah, probably about 4 or 5 years ago, if I'm remembering correctly, they did a great expose on this. And probably your number one clue that this is a scam, other than it not being a stem cell treatment that's legitimate, is that they're offering it in, you know, the Philippines or in Venezuela or something. You have to leave the country in order to get this treatment.
Yeah. Outside of the regulatory protection, you know, that would normally exist. Yeah, that's a red flag.
Yeah, big red flag.
Yeah, and it's pretty predictive. Yeah. So don't fly around the world, spend tens of thousands of dollars on stem cells, you know, with dubious claims, because you're probably going to be harmed and completely ripped off.
Yeah. And you're going to be worse for wear after it, which is really scary. So we mentioned some of these things, some of these interesting brain phenomena. I mean, ultimately, you were a scientist, kind of a jack of all trades scientist. You loved science. You studied every type of science. And it seems like you did something that's very different than a lot of the people that I know that ultimately went to medical school, in that you were a science-based thinker first. Now, I'm not saying that most doctors are not science-based thinkers, but I do know a lot of physicians who studied biology or chemistry almost exclusively and really focused on medicine only and not on the scientific process before they ended up finishing. So there are, you know, a ton of really brilliant MD PhDs out there that are strong scientists. And there are just some doctors out there who really focus and support evidence-based medicine. But this doesn't exemplify the entire medical community, does it?
Yeah. So, you know, medical school training is really, you're being trained in a trade, you know, and you can be a reasonably competent physician by knowing how to practice medicine well, but without really being a solid critical thinker. It's a little challenging. You have to rely more on just sort of memorizing what the right thing to do is. I do think ultimately it limits how good you can be if you're not a good critical thinker as a physician. But I see the whole spectrum, right? You know, among my various colleagues, not so much at Yale, because that's a pretty good, you know, academic institution. So that's at one end of the spectrum, in, you know, mainly speaking. But if you look at also doctors in the community, and I lecture to doctors in the community and talk to a lot of doctors, so you see the whole spectrum. You could have a physician who's in their field with what they're doing day to day practicing medicine. They're completely competent physicians, but they may be complete true believers and have no critical thinking skills whatsoever outside of what they've learned, you know, those sort of rails that they have when they're practicing medicine. And then there are others that are brilliant all-purpose scientists who are just focusing on issues that are related to medicine. You see the whole spectrum. But unfortunately, I do think that most physicians are that in the middle, where they're basically have, you know, reasonable scientific literacy, but especially for those fields that are most pertinent to medicine. But they don't particularly have well-developed critical thinking skills, you know, like above-average critical thinking skills, or knowledge of pseudoscience. Then at one end of the spectrum, there are skeptical doctors who are critical thinkers, understand fraud, understand pseudoscience, and can apply that to medicine. And at the opposite them, there's the, you know, 3, 4, 5% who are true believers, you know, and incorporate that into their medical practice. These are the few percent who are practicing homeopathy and, you know, just are embracing the pseudoscience,
but who are otherwise legitimate licensed physicians.
Yes.
I mean, legitimate's a hard word to say, but who went to medical school, who
have MDs,
MDs and passed all the tests that they needed to pass and can legally practice medicine.
Right. Right. And I don't think they're the best doctors. I think they're actually among the worst doctors, because I do think that in order to be a really good physician, you have to be able to think critically. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. Thinking clinically is thinking critically, and it's not easy. It takes a long time to really learn that. You have to understand the things that bias our thinking, both in evaluating diagnosis as well as outcomes of therapy. And if you're not aware of those things, you will fall prey to all of those biases, and physicians often do. But
that's dangerous, because then their patients are subject to that. I mean, I'm assuming, and tell me if I'm wrong in this assumption, that you are in the camp that thinks that there should be regulation, that physicians who are licensed, you know, who practice medicine, should be regulated against also practicing homeopathy or chiropractic or anything like that.
Yeah, well, they are in a way, in that, the practice of medicine, by the way, is regulated by the states. The federal government mm-hmm. does not regulate the practice of medicine. The FDA regulates drugs. The FTC regulates advertising. But the practice of medicine is regulated by the states, who are the ones who license professionals. And each state has its own regulations as to what physicians are allowed to do. There is essentially what is called the standard of care, and physicians are held to the standard of care within their specialty. Mm-hmm. That's I think reasonable, but it has to be enforced well. You know, it's really easy, because it's so vague, we're going to enforce the standard of care. And what is the standard of care? Well, we determine that case by case, moment by moment. You know, it's like, what's the standard of care today in this field? You know, it is a moving target, so you need regulations that are versatile, that could move with the standard. That's the good thing. The bad side is that, you know, if states decide not to be very proactive in enforcing the standard of care, then it doesn't matter. Even worse, a lot of states, I don't know what the exact number is up to now, but it was around 20 last time I checked, have passed so-called healthcare freedom laws, which essentially eliminate the standard of care. It says that, well, if you're practicing quote-unquote alternative medicine, you can't be held to the standard of care. So the state actually doesn't even have the power to act against the license of a practitioner. All they have to do is label what they're doing alternative. It's a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Oh, my God, that's doubly scary.
It's horrible.
It's the one thing that needs to be regulated.
Absolutely. So then physicians could literally get away with anything as long as they go, oh, by the way, what I'm doing here, this is alternative. Okay, magically, no standard of care. So then the patient can always complain about a doctor. That's not taken away, but that's a much higher standard. The state can't take it upon themselves to say, oh, look at this. This guy is practicing quackery. You can't do that. It's like, well, yes, I can. The law now shields me from state regulation. It's horrible. We're moving in the wrong. Yeah, it's anti-consumer. We're moving in the wrong direction, you know. So, but that's being done state by state in the dead of night under the guise of healthcare freedom laws. And unfortunately, it's one of those things where if you have a dedicated group of people lobbying the government for a specific law, it's really hard to keep them at bay forever. You just have to turn your back for one moment and like, what happened? You know, it's suddenly the law gets through. So these things get ratcheted into place.
And it almost reminds me of tort reform. Like these groups, these movements actually do a good job of kind of convincing the public that it's in their best interest.
Right.
Which is just insane.
Yes.
Because it's a complicated thing. And they go, oh, there's too much, you know, there's these litigious lawsuits, or these people are too litigious, and we've got to protect the doctors because people try to sue them, and then your bills are going to go up. So this is actually better for you.
Yeah, exactly. And they've convinced the public that it's in their interest mm-hmm. not to be protected from fraud and quackery.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
That's so scary. And to not be able to, for example, have the power of the lawsuit if a large corporation does take advantage of them or harms them. You know, that's the other side of that coin. It's so crazy. We have to have consumer advocacy out there. We have to have our rights protected too. And the fact that these lobbying groups are so good at spinning the message to make us seem, it's, I think, why people vote against their own interests all the time.
Yeah.
Well, they're convinced not to.
People vote along ideological lines, regardless of what their self-interest is. But yeah, it's like, where are the consumer protection groups in this? They're asleep at the switch. They totally don't understand that this is an anti-consumer movement that's happening right under their nose. They're utterly failing. Academia is largely failing because they're being presented this in a certain way. The regulators, politicians are largely failing. Again, not in every single instance, but you know, over time they've been failing because they're being told the correct ideological thing. So, you know, fraud and quackery in healthcare has been on a steady march, not because people want it, not because there's any difference or any change in the scientific evidence, but because the con artists and the charlatans have been brilliant in repackaging, you know, their snake oil in a way to legitimize it. And it's really been a massive swindle on the public.
That's such a bummer. You know, I have to ask, and feel free to tell me if you're not comfortable giving your opinion on this publicly, because I know that on the show, at least, you don't often go into politics or talk about people, individual rogues, political preferences. But I think this can be somewhat divorced from politics. Are you somebody who thinks that universal healthcare, or that, you know, a centralized system of healthcare in this country would be better for the populace?
That is a complicated question, and it is wrapped up in ideology and, you know, economic systems as well as science. So, if I try to look at it as what would yield the best outcomes, it's hard to say because it's a trade-off. Mm-hmm. If you look at other countries that have national or centralized healthcare services, they do better at some things but worse at others. They ration care more because they just can't afford to give it. Mm-hmm. If you go to the UK, it's great if you have an acute injury and need to go to the emergency room. It's wonderful. If you need to go on dialysis when you're 60, it sucks because you're not going to get it, you know.
And mental health is really hard there too.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I'm not a fan of insurance companies because they can be pretty irrational at times and hard to deal with. They're not completely awful. They also make an earnest effort to constrain waste because that happens to also be in their interest. If essentially what you'd be doing is making the federal government one big health insurance company. Mm-hmm. And we have experience with that. Medicare and Medicaid are essentially federal health insurance. You know, Medicare and Medicaid are terrible insurance companies. I mean, if you want everyone to be under a similar system, you have to deal with this massive bureaucracy. It's actually the regulations are much crazier than the private health insurance companies. It's really hard, and there's no appeal because it's the government. You know, I can appeal an insurance company decision. So there's a lot of things to consider that I think the American public are not aware of. What the system would really be like. I mean, yeah, right now they're very intimately familiar with the insanity and the inconveniences of the private health insurance company system. Mm-hmm. But if you ever had to deal with the government, you know, in any of the things like either in the VA system or Medicare or Medicaid, it's not a bunch of roses over there either. You're just trading one set of problems for another set of problems. So I actually think it's a neutral change as far as the quality of healthcare.
Interesting. That's an interesting perspective.
Yeah. It may help in terms of efficiency or whatever, but again, even that's complicated because we're such a huge society. You know, you can't compare Sweden to the US. It's just,
exactly.
We're too huge. So, but you think one of the things that really matter, in terms of the quality of healthcare and even in some ways efficiency, and it's kind of a lateral move to go over to the government. Because think about Obamacare. You know, that's again another little peek into what the situation would be like. You have interest groups lobbying the government to get the clauses that they want in the rules so that their quackery sells. You know, that just makes it. The only advantage there is that we're fighting one fight instead of 50 fights, you know, in every state. But even still, we would be beholden to politics in terms of passing rational laws. And, things like, you know, when the healthcare debate came up, the Republicans brought up this idea of death panels.
Yeah.
It utterly killed a conversation that we desperately need to have. If you want to cut out the low-hanging fruit of waste in the healthcare system is futile care to people who cannot possibly benefit from it because they're going to die no matter what we do. But we don't really have a good system of preventing that waste. And any discussion about how to do that was instantly killed by one political slogan. Death panels. Over. Can't talk about it. And so that's what we'd be dealing with if, you know, everything was managed at the federal level. It really would just be a different venue and a different set of challenges. But really not, I don't think it would not instantly be objectively better.
So true to think about it that way. And it's a perspective that I don't often take because, you know, as somebody with the political views that I have, I've always advocated for a single payer system. But it's almost kind of in a philosophical sense, like, of course, this would be better for the masses. But we kind of forget, oh, wait, we're talking about our own federal government that exactly. We have to apply this to. It's not happening in a vacuum. And like you said, we're not Sweden. There are places where this works in many ways much better because yeah. The government works better and because there are way less people.
Yeah, but it's one of those things that looks great on paper, mm-hmm. but you know, think about it. Our bureaucracy is going to have to run a horrifically massive, you know, situation like that. And when has it ever done that? I mean, you know, think about the post office and Amtrak yeah. or whatever. And these things are much, much smaller. It's just things get, this is kind of an aside, but I think as the deeper principle is, I think that as our civilization is just massive, right? We're over 7 billion people. We have over 300 million people in our country. And our technology is getting complicated. I think we are running up to this situation where our society is almost too complicated for people to manage. Mm-hmm. And it's really challenging. We're running up against, I think, ultimate limits about our ability to run massive, complicated systems. And we have to really figure out almost new philosophies, new technologies, new methods of managing these systems. And just like turning over healthcare to a massive bureaucracy without those, you know, systems in place is a scary proposition. Again, not that what we have now is great. It's crazy. You know, so,
it's crazy. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely like rethinking everything from the ground up, which is almost impossible to do with our government structure the way that it is, with lobbying being basically legal. I mean, it's very hard to get anything accomplished. I definitely could see a single payer being necessary for catastrophic health care. You know, like everybody should have, anybody should be able to walk into a hospital and say, I chopped off my arm, you need to reattach it, you know?
Yeah,
and the fact
absolutely.
That some people can't do that because they can't afford to pay for it, to me, is an abomination.
Yeah, but they just so you know, though, if you walk into the emergency room, you'll get whatever you need.
Yeah.
It's just the system absorbs the cost, which gets
which
passed on to everybody else.
Yeah,
yeah exactly.
Yeah.
So it's ultimately getting done and getting paid for just inefficiently. So that's, yeah, there's definitely some, you know, I think universal coverage is a no-brainer. We definitely need universal coverage. I haven't heard anybody disagree with that because uncovered, uninsured people, that's just, it's morally wrong and it's very inefficient. So that's the only no-brainer, which is, I think, the best thing about Obamacare is that it had as a primary goal, universal coverage. But going even further to like abolishing private health insurance and abolishing anything at the state
level. Exactly. At the very least, that's what we have.
That's, you know, that's tricky. I think that I haven't heard anybody say, here's the system we should have and say, yeah, that's it. That's what I agree with. There's no one perfect system. It's always a system of trade-offs. I do think that there's something to be said for having 50 experiments. You know, let states experiment to some degree and maybe we'll figure something out, you know, and then replicate what works. I think we might be in that phase rather than saying, all right, we know what federal one national healthcare system to build. I don't think we're quite there yet. I don't think we know how to build a really effective national healthcare system that could work, that will make everybody happy and, you know, be efficient and won't have all the horrible downsides that people will find unacceptable.
Sure. And having it at the individual state level is more like having it happening in Sweden. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a smaller group of people. It's more manageable. And people, the hope is that the representatives know what their constituency wants and needs. And that doesn't always work out to be the case, but at least a little bit better than trying to manage, you know, everybody in the United States.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. All right. Well, we're running really low on time, and I always end every podcast the same way. So I want to make sure that I have a chance to do that with you, too. At the very end of the podcast, I ask all of my guests the exact same two questions. And one day I might compile the answers. Who knows? We'll see. But in the meantime, I am definitely interested to hear your take on it. And I start with the bummer question and end with the uplifting one. So in this order, when you think of the future in whatever context matters to you, whether it's personal or global, whatever, when you think of the future, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? What concerns you the most? What are you most worried about? And then on the flip side of that, what are you looking forward to the most? What are you most optimistic about?
Yeah, I mean, I worry about a lot of things for the future. So I'll pick one that we've been talking about, and that's kind of close to what I do. I worry that pseudoscience is going to become endemic within medicine, to the point where it's just going to be taken for granted. It's going to be woven into the system. It's going to be impossible to extricate, and then it'll be taken for granted. And once people, you know, once it's there long enough, people will see it as something, as a right. You know what I mean? As something that will be impossible to take away. That, you know, there's permanent damage being done by the infiltration of pseudoscience into the healthcare profession. I mean, the kind of thing that could resonate for hundreds of years. That I'm very concerned about that. When I think about the future, what I always get excited about is, you know, unsurprisingly, technological advances. Mm-hmm. I think that there, you know, we have been and will continue to utterly transform our world in good ways, in interesting ways, obviously in some scary ways too, but I think in generally in a good way. And I'm always looking forward to, you know, how the world is going to change tomorrow because of our technology. I think that we will solve a lot of problems that seem unsolvable today just simply through the incremental march of progress. For example, like I think that our energy problems, we're going to, you know, I don't think there's going to be a political solution to that. I think there's going to be a technological solution to that. And it'll come. It'll come when it comes. You know, it'll come when we develop the technology. Like, for example, solar is actually becoming economically efficient now. You know, it's actually, people are building more solar and wind than fossil fuel because it's actually more cost effective. And I don't think any political tweak was going to affect that, you know. That was going to happen when the technology was ready, and I don't think any politician was going to make it happen any sooner.
If anything, it might affect the political outlooks downstream.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to change people's opinions because it is this thing that exists regardless of how you feel about it.
Yeah, in a way that I think the technology will drive the politics rather than the other way around. So I think, and to back up, what I'm really saying is that I have a lot of faith in human smarts and ingenuity. I think the best of us are brilliant and we have the power to change the world in a very positive way.
I love that. That really is ending on a very high note, I think. So I thank you for that. So before we go, I just want to give you a chance to do that thing we do, which is plug SGU, tell everybody when it comes out, where they can find it, how they can get in touch, all that good stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, basically you can get to all of our vast multimedia social networking empire that we're building by going to theskepticsguide.org. That's our main webpage. You can search for us on Twitter, on Facebook, but you can get pretty much to everything through theskepticsguide.org. We have a weekly science podcast that's kind of our flagship production that comes, that's published every Saturday at noon, give or take a little bit.
Okay, great. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for spending the hour with me. I learned a lot listening and chatting with you.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
So much fun. And everybody, thank you so much for tuning in week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk here.